A federal judge in Medford says he could rule by next week on whether Jackson County's anti-GMO crop ordinance will be allowed to take effect as scheduled in early June. The judge presided over a hearing on the case yesterday in Medford. This is just the latest in a series of developments in the ongoing debate over GMO, genetically modified organisms, or the alternate terminology, GE for genetic engineering. Our first guest today knows the science very well and took part in a process to review some of the issues facing GMO in Oregon. Dr. Dan Arp is the Rube Long Dean of Agricultural Sciences and Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station at Oregon State University, and also was the co-convener of a governor's task force on GE agriculture. Dan Arp, thanks for joining us today in the Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you. Let's talk about being part of the governor's task force and the process there. How did you get informed that you had been chosen for this last year?
Well, the lucky call for me came, I believe it was late December in 2013, and received a phone call from actually the director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Katie Koba. She and I worked together closely in our parallel roles, both at the university and her at the ODA, and asked if I'd be willing to co-chair this task force that the governor was pulling together. So that's how that got started.
I'm glad you used the term lucky. I was going to ask you what that was like, oh boy, here it comes. I mean, what was that basically the feeling you had when the call came?
Well, it was, but at the same time, I recognized how important this work was. It was really important to get a group together that could talk about this issue and try and frame it in a way that got beyond the rhetoric and actually looked at the issues. And that was the task that we were given, and so I was happy to be able to try and participate in that.
I have to believe this is a subject you deal with daily at Oregon State University. In what capacity?
Well, so we deal with this in a number of different ways. I mean, certainly one of the things we try to do is to provide information that the public can take a look at and try and make their own decisions or come to their own conclusions about what's happening. We also deal with this in our research on campus. So it might be worth a slight digression here. When you think about genetically engineered organisms, a lot of the conversation is about them as commercial products, as plants. But we actually use them very extensively in our research here on campus and have done so for over 30 years. So use them in plants, in bacteria, and in animals. And it's just a terrific tool for understanding how living systems work.
And, I mean, some of this on outdoor farms, some of this in indoor laboratories, it sounds like a mix of things.
It is a mix. It's certainly a mix. Most of it is done in laboratories. We need to make sure that we contain things. If we take things out into the field, then there are certain restrictions, regulations that we need to follow, which, of course, we do, but that makes it a bit more difficult. So most of the work is done in laboratories, in greenhouses.
If the Benton County had a ballot measure 289 this week about, I think it was called agricultural rights, that sort of measure. But and if it had passed, which it did not, it went down by a 3-1 margin nearly, what would have happened potentially to the experimental farms at Oregon State University?
Well, so that depended entirely on how one interpreted the words in the measure. There were certainly words there that said that all genetically engineered organisms would need to be destroyed within 90 days of passage. So the concern at the university was that this would apply to those research tools that I just mentioned, the plants, the bacteria, the animals that we use as research tools in our work, and that those would have need to have been destroyed. The question was whether or not it actually applied to research or whether it was limited to things related to food systems. So that was a question that probably would have had to have been sorted out by the courts.
Which is not necessary since it did not pass.
At this point, not necessary, right.
Curious to know, about is there a general thrust about the genetic research that goes on at OSU with crops in particular?
Oh, with crops in particular, yes, there is actually. And the thrust is in identifying genes that are useful in different ways. So imagine that we have disease resistance that we can find in one variety of, let's say, wheat, but that variety of wheat is not the perfect one to grow in Northeast Oregon. So now what we do is try and identify the resistance, the gene or genes responsible for resistance, and then can now move those over into the varieties that are best in Northeast Oregon. Now, they can be moved by a variety of techniques, traditional plant breeding being the one that's used most often. Of course, you can also use genetic engineering. But the main way in which we're going to use that technology is to identify those genes that are of interest.
So this gets into a really interesting area every time we talk about this, because it seems like nobody blinks when we talk about hybridization or cross-pollination, but the hard line of controversy seems to focus on a tool, which people refer to over and over again as the gene gun.
Yes, the gene gun is a tool. It is one way to introduce these genes now into plant varieties. So genetic engineering, maybe I can step back one step. So typically genetic engineering, not typically, always, it involves a step where the DNA is engineered essentially in a test tube. So something has been changed about the DNA. Sometimes it's the addition of a gene. The most commonly used crops have a gene added into that DNA. Now, that's in a test tube. Now, the challenge is, how do we get it from the test tube into the plant? And the gene gun is one of the tools that is used for doing that. So it actually then introduces that engineered DNA back into the plant.
But it could be DNA engineered from the plant itself, not necessarily the mouse genes into tomatoes and that sort of thing.
That's correct.
All right. I noticed, Dr. Nanarp, from early remarks on the task force report, that the task force steered clear of attempting to cover the state of the science or scientific consensus. If you'd gotten into that zone, I mean, how much longer might the report have taken, both in time and in pages?
So it would have taken, I mean, it's hard, of course, to estimate that, but it would have taken much longer by multiples. So in other words, it would have taken 2, 3, 4 times longer, something along those lines. And it, partly because it would have then required bringing in experts on the science. We had some panel members who were experts in various aspects of the science, but not all aspects. So as we would have gotten into more of that, it would have required more time bringing in experts, more time to read the relevant literature. And there is a very extensive literature out there on these topics.
And let me back up a step then, because I didn't ask yet what the period of time you got to prepare the report was, and when the report was put out.
So, yeah, very good. We started our work in April, so although I received my phone call in December, it took a while to bring together the rest of the group and then establish task force topics, things we wanted to talk about, sort of figure out how we were going to approach our work. So we started in April of last year, and then met about every 3 weeks for a period of 8 months, 7 months. So it was in November that we finally finished up our work, and then the report came out in December.
Dr. Nanarp is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Dean of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University, and last year the co-chair of the Governor's Task Force on GE Agriculture. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Just in general, Nanarp, how widespread is the growing of GE crops at this point in Oregon?
Well, so that's one of the interesting things that came out of the task force work. We don't know. So we don't. There aren't records that would indicate how many acres of GE crops are grown in Oregon. Now, if you look at the roughly 220 commodities that we have in the state, and how many of those, many of those being plants, very few of those have GE genetically engineered varieties available. For the ones that do, they're alfalfa, sugar beets are probably the two most common that are grown in the state. What percentage of those, so if you look out and you see an alfalfa field, what's the chance that that's a genetically engineered alfalfa? We really don't know at this point.
And in the case of alfalfa, because that is actually the centerpiece of the lawsuit in Jackson County, what is it they're seeking to gain through genetic engineering? Is that another pesticide-resistant thing or herbicide-resistant thing?
It is herbicide-resistant, yes. It's the so-called Roundup Ready, so an herbicide, glyphosate, which has been a gene that provides the plant resistance to that. It's been engineered into that plant.
All right, we have a call here from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Nanarp.
Good morning. Two questions. One, was the person who spoke on this subject yesterday correct in saying that if her crop were cross-pollinated with a genetically engineered crop, that she could not save or sell the seeds due to the patent laws? And second question is, what percentage of the research money for the ag school at Oregon State comes from the state government? What percentage from the federal government? What percentage from industry?
Okay, yeah. Sure.
All right, thanks for that, Mark.
So on the first question, I'm not an expert on this. My understanding, though, is that if that trait got into someone's seeds, they could not sell those seeds. They would not wouldn't want to be in a position where they were trying to sell them as genetically engineered seed with that trait. With respect to the question about the research at Oregon State University, and I'll refer specifically to what goes on in the College of Ag Sciences, because that's, of course, where I'm most familiar. The state component of what we do is approximately 30-35%. The federal government component is about 60%, and that leaves about 5% or so that comes from private money, and included in that is commodity money. So hopefully it gives you some sense of where that money comes from. And the private money is a mix of money from commodity commissions as well as dollars from directly from private industry. Some people wonder how much of that we get from the companies that are engaged in making genetically engineered crops, and it's really a very small percentage of the total dollars that we have for our research.
Well, it seems that the names that always come up in this discussion are Monsanto and Syngenta, so I guess I'll just ask if they have any money in OSU's process.
So Syngenta, I'm not aware of. I don't know that we have any. Monsanto sponsors two scholarships for undergraduate students that go to their facility in Hawaii each summer. To the best of my knowledge, that's the only funds that we receive from Monsanto and the college right now.
Okay, forgive me, Dan Arp, if I flop from track to track, but we have the interesting work that goes on at OSU and the interesting work of the task force last year. And so coming back to the task force, I'm struck by one of the themes explored that the task force pointed out that many issues in genetic engineering are not exclusive to GE crops.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. So a lot of the things that people are concerned about with GE crops are also issues that are relevant to all crops. So resistant weeds being one good example. So people look at the use of Roundup Ready, and one of the concerns about Roundup Ready crops is that you now have weeds that are developing that are resistant to glyphosate. But resistance to herbicides has been a problem in the use of herbicides since we started using them. So that's just one example of how you have that issue.
Resistant in the sense they build up a tolerance over time just from being exposed to those herbicides?
Yes. Yeah, and tolerance, it usually has a genetic basis. So usually what happens is a mutation within that plant that now, within the weed, which now it gives it essentially the same tolerance or resistance that the target crop has.
Okay, one person's weed is another person's flower. When we talk about weeds in this context, we're talking about different species other than what the herbicides were laid out for? I mean, to protect?
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. So the idea, of course, is that let's take the alfalfa, go back to the alfalfa issue. So alfalfa normally would die when sprayed with glyphosate or Roundup, but with the gene inserted into the plant now that gives it resistance, you can spray the plant with Roundup and it won't die. But the weeds in the field will die because they are sensitive to that herbicide, Roundup or glyphosate. But the concern is that with time and with exposure, you can begin to select for those weeds that have resistance to the glyphosate, and now they are also not killed when sprayed with glyphosate or Roundup.
So, Dan, some of these other issues that arise, I mean, the major one seems to be the idea of drift, that if the guy down the road is doing GE sugar beets and I'm doing non-GE sugar beets, his stuff could blow over here and contaminate my crop. Did any of this happen before we got to the whole gene gun end of things? I mean, with people doing hybrids down the road, did you get those sorts of complaints even years ago?
Well, so yes, that has been a concern for years, and a very good example of that is in the Willamette Valley, where you have a very large, very vibrant seed-growing industry, but many different kinds of seeds being grown. And a simple example of that is you can't have my white radishes contaminated with your red radishes because we get the wrong radish coming out of that. So farmers there, growers, have worked for years, for decades, and establishing mechanisms of coexistence so they can make sure that they're not interfering with each other's growing habits.
All right. We're talking to Dan Arp, the Dean of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University here on the Jefferson Exchange. Last year, he also co-chaired the Governor's Task Force on GE Agriculture with a report that can be obtained easily online. Let's go to Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff and Dr. Arp. It seems to me that one of the major questions is whether or not science is, I'm talking about reliable science now, has found any harm caused to the human body by the consumption of genetically engineered products. I know the opponents of the GMO, anti-GMO folks claim that there's all kinds of danger, but could you answer that question for me?
All right, thank you for that, Bill.
Yeah, so if one looks at the consensus reports that have come from a number of different groups, so these are FDA, so the Food and Drug Administration, the National Academy of Sciences, the Association for the Advancement of Science, so a number of groups where a group of scientists have gotten together and looked at the information, they have consistently concluded that there is no harm from consumption of GMO foods, essentially, there's no difference between them and their non-GMO counterparts. So that's been the conclusion. It's not to say that one shouldn't continue to pay attention, but that's been the consensus of those groups.
Is it an overwhelming consensus? Is it a 3-2 split or anything like that?
It's been an overwhelming consensus.
All right. And I know that this gets into the point where back to Mark's question about money in the process. I mean, I'm sure there are a fair amount of claims that people get bought to do the reports a certain way. But are you satisfied that most of the research you've read in this field is independent research?
So there's certainly a combination. So there's a little bit of confusion here that's probably worth trying to explain. Mm-hmm. So in order to get a crop deregulated, so that's the term that USDA, FDA, and EPA use in order to say, well, it's okay to grow this, the company has to provide information to FDA. Now, that's provided by the company if it's Monsanto, Syngenta, and so on. So that's their work that they're doing to present to that agency in order for the agency to say, okay, we're with you, we're convinced this is okay. There's also a great deal of independent work that's going on at the same time. A recent study looked at about, I believe the number was 1,200 independent manuscripts that had been published around different aspects of GE crops. And so that's kind of the number of papers that are out there. So, yes, there's a lot of work that's been done in building that consensus.
All right, another call here from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Dan Arp.
Thank you very much. There are countries in this world that know for a fact that glyphosate is a carcinogen, and for anybody to be working at adapting plants to tolerate glyphosate, Roundup to some of us.
Glyphosate, yeah.
Yeah, we are making a market for more carcinogens. This is the equivalent of saying, let's go back to putting lead in gasoline because there's a profit and a reason to do it. This is fostering toxic exposure to us. I'm not talking about after the plants are grown, is it a worry to eat GMO foods. I'm talking about exposure to glyphosate. It's making super weeds that are inconquerable in the South already, and it is carcinogenic, and it's banned other places. For anybody to be working to increase the use of Roundup, I think that is immoral.
All right. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Appreciate it. Dan, any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that he's certainly welcome to his opinion. There are certainly others who have other opinions. Again, if you look at the scientific consensus, it's not quite as clear as what was just presented there. For example, EPA has looked at glyphosate on a number of occasions and does not have that same concern with it.
All right. I want to get back to the task force in the minute or two we have left here and talk about some of the findings here and some of the areas you explored. For one thing, the regulatory situation, because there was a discussion, it appears, among the task force members about state versus federal regulation. Is there something of a vacuum where perhaps a more federal regulation might have been effective on guiding a way forward with exploring the use of GE crops?
So I think that the concern that was expressed by the task force is that you have different agencies look at GE crops for different reasons, but the concern is that there's not always as coordinated as it could be. So concerned that things could fall through the cracks because of the way that the federal regulation is done.
All right, Stephen and Eugene emails, are there any studies that look at the impact of genetically engineered crops and bees, and would it impact Dan and the university's research work if patents on genetic engineering were banned in Oregon?
So I'm not in a position to be able to answer that first question. I don't know about any specific studies that have been done around GE crops and bees. That's certainly a good question. Mm-hmm. I just don't know the answer to that. And then the second one was, what was the second question?
Would it impact Dan and OSU's research work if patents on genetic engineering were banned in Oregon?
If patents on GE were banned in Oregon, mm-hmm. Today it would not. No.
Really? Okay.
So, no, I'm not sure how that would have any impact on our current work at OSU. No.
Okay, another phone question from Kent in Rogue River. Welcome to the exchange.
Hi, good morning. Two questions. One, how do you feel about the fact that Syngenta walked out of a pinning meeting, which basically was what you were talking about, the cooperation that occurs in the Willamette Valley? They didn't want to discuss anything other than they wanted to have control of the meeting. And two, it's my understanding that if you want to do research on a GE crop, particularly Monsanto's, you cannot obtain the raw material, the crop itself, because they have patents on it and they prohibit research. And given that, how can you trust anything that you hear?
Okay, short answer. Thanks for that, Kent.
So let's see. Short answer on the first part of that, I, of course, really can't comment on what was going on in those meetings. I wasn't a part of those, so mm-hmm. I don't know what was happening there and why, you know, why Syngenta didn't continue in those conversations. Let's see. There's really not a very short answer to the second part of that question either. It is true that that Monsanto will control those seeds, so they will make them available for research, but on their terms.
All right.
So it's their choice.
We've learned a lot today. You can find the task force report that Dan Arp was part of last year online. Dan Arp is the Dean of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care.
Bye.